Welcome to this podcast from the Presbyterian Church in Ireland, exploring aspects of our life and witness at this time.
Well, welcome to the PCI podcast, and we are recording here on the eve of General Assembly, and one of the highlights for me of General Assembly is always getting to welcome people from our partners overseas. It's great when you've been corresponding with people and you know of organisations, but it's so different when you get to actually sit down with people and talk to them face to face. So it's a real privilege to be here with three of our partners. We have guests from Malawi, Hungary and Lebanon today. So firstly, you are very welcome. Very welcome to Belfast and very welcome to PCI. And thank you for being here and taking the time. I'm also joined by David McCullough, who is the convener of our Global Mission Partnership panel. And we're just going to have a bit of a chat about partnerships, about the world, about what's going on in the church around the world. So it's just a great opportunity to be able to focus a bit on the global church and what's happening around the world. So if we could just open up even by everyone just introducing yourself, say who you are, where you're from, and the church or organisation that you're representing. So Amir, shall we start with you?
Sure, with pleasure. First of all, thank you very much for having us over. I love everything I've seen over the past 24 hours. My name is Amir. I was born in Paris, but I'm Syrian in origin, and I lived most of my life in Damascus. I went to Lebanon to study at the American University of Beirut. And now I am leading Compassion Protestant Society, which is the diaconal arm of the National Evangelical Synod in Syria and Lebanon.
Yeah, thanks for this opportunity. I'm Julia Beretz from the Reformed Church in Hungary, and I work in the central offices of our church as an ecumenical officer. I'm the one who's responsible for international relations of our church.
Yes, I am Reverend Brian Kamwendo. I come from Malawi, and I am from one of the synods, which is called Nkoma Synod, considering that our nation, the Protestant church in Malawi is divided based on the regions that we have, the northern region, the central region, as well as the southern region. And I do come from the synod, which is in the central region, which is called Nkoma Synod, that has actually been in partnership with PCI for a number of years now. And I do appreciate, especially because of the partnership that we have, and I also bring greetings from the other sister synods, because I also informed them that I was given this privilege to be here. I'm the general secretary of the synod, which has got 1.2 million members and 28 presbyteries and other departments, education, health, and other stuff. Thank you.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the countries that you've come from. We'll have seen various bits and pieces about them on our news, some more than others, in the last little while, but it would be great to know just a bit about the situations there and what's happening there again.
Well, starting with Lebanon first, I'd like to apologize for monopolizing the news for the past I don't know how long. The situation has been and continues to be precarious. It's a bit difficult to describe because it's been heavy bombardment, full-on war for several years now, except that war is localized. So you'd have decimated regions and just a couple of blocks away from that, regions that only heard the noise. And this is causing a lot of polarization. And personally, working in the field and trying to walk alongside the most vulnerable, I feel that as bad and damaging as the bombardment, the violence is, what really is the biggest concern for me is the day after there's a ceasefire, when people have to sit together and try to reflect and build a future. And the space for that is really diminishing by the hour. What that means for the Christians is also a lot of polarization within the church. There are those who are being led by preservation mindset. So let's just steer away from that conflict. It's not ours. We never called for it. And let them, quote unquote, take the brunt of it. And then there's the other side who feel that this is the time to be missional. This is the time to express our identity. and to take risks. And if not, then what kind of church are we? And there's a bit of tension also between these two sides. So this is about Lebanon today. It's been going on. It's not just the war between Hezbollah and Israel, but also the many different things that happened over the past 5 years that really led the country to a place that is really unstable. Economic collapse, the port explosion, COVID, Syria refugee crisis that hasn't ended yet. The war in Syria ended, but there's still about 1.5 million refugee in Lebanon.
Okay. And CPS, the organization that you work for, do you work, is it just in Lebanon or is it in Syria as well?
It's in Lebanon and Syria, but it's mostly in Lebanon for various reasons. First, the legal framework allows for CPS to be legally registered, whereas in Syria, it's still a work in progress. We still don't know what exactly are the guidelines to do so. So we work through the churches, but not as formally a formally present organization. In Lebanon, also, we lean heavily on the legacy of educational institutions that we have. So we have 7 private schools, and it followed naturally that we established non-formal education centers for refugee students. And that has been about 70% of everything we did in the past 5 years. Still, CPS is new, and it's reinventing itself constantly. Today, alongside education, we also are starting a peace-building program and a church and community development program, in addition, of course, to humanitarian assistance, which we do every time we have a crisis. And unfortunately, we always have a crisis. But I mean, it's since you've asked, the reason why CPS exists is as an expression of the Synod's desire to reach out to those who are beyond the walls of the church. We have committees in the Synod that take care of the congregations, but we wanted something that is formally there to assist those who are not part of the church. So this is what CPS focuses on. The vast majority of our beneficiaries and participants, about 99%, are non-Christians.
Okay. And you say you do that through the church?
We try to do that through the church when possible. That's our strategy. But at the same time, sometimes it's not possible for logistic reasons, so we just do it directly.
And Julia, can you tell us a bit about Hungary and the wider area that you work in?
Yeah, so in Hungary, we have been experiencing major political changes. That is most widely a consequence of the general elections that we have in last April. And it means that the governing party, who was in power for 16 years in the country, has lost the elections. I believe it's still too early to draw the conclusions of what we are heading to, or to evaluate policies. But still we can feel the changes, and we feel there might be new directions the political arena heading into in Hungary. I believe in terms of the European community, Hungary was very often regarded as the black sheep or a bit of outsider. These changes that we have and the results of the recent elections might result in us getting back to the more general European perspective or experiencing and getting in line with the big European trends. In terms of societal trend and political trend. But the elections also meant that our society got very much polarized and fragmented. So we have to struggle with that. We have to face the realities of that fragmentation as well. It is a major, not only political, but societal change. And it has an influence on the church's ministry as well. For 16 years in Hungary, we had a government who was conservative, and it was elected by a vast majority of the electors. So they also used and borrowed notions, expressions, and ideas from Christianity. It meant that some of their policies were in line with the biblical teaching, and some of their policies were not. And now there are a lot of discussions about the responsibility of the churches how we take a stock of what happened, what was said by the churches and what was were not said, when were the situations where we were silent, although we had to speak up. When you have a conservative government, churches in some respect might have the temptation to get into a very comfortable situation that, yes, politics handle the hard issues, and we don't have to go into deep discussions. And I believe that happened in Hungary. And now we need to get into a new phase in terms of our relationship with society and how we live out our faith in the society. And this is true for all denominations. So it's true for Catholics, and it's true for my denomination, Reformed Church, as well. In Hungary, churches and the Reformed Church as well are heavily involved in the social and education system. But due to these changes and the lack of that prophetic voice means also that the general feeling or the general public opinion towards churches is less favorable in the society. So that's definitely a challenge that we all face. And I believe in that bigger perspective, we need to get strengthened in our calling and also be ready to interpret and convey the message of Christianity and the gospel to the wider society. Yes, I.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's much that you say there that we can probably relate to here as well, yeah. in Northern Ireland, and even the fact that both of you have mentioned polarization as well. You know, we're in very different contexts, but a lot of our issues are the same. Brian, can you tell us about Malawi?
Sure. Malawi is a nation that has got a population of approximately right now 22 million. Because usually we do have our census, population census, every 10 years. And the last one, of course, took place in 2018. So we are looking forward to the other official census to take place in 2028. But as we stand right now, the approximation that we are using is the one that is standing at 22 million. In terms of the one of the challenges is population growth, because, for example, like in 1964, Malawi only had about 6 million people. Yes, but from that 6 million 1964 to this range, you can actually see that the population has indeed grown. Having 118 square kilometers, which is about 118 square kilometers, one third of Malawi is water. And interestingly, even though we talk about one third of Malawi being water, we do have a lake there, which is one of the major lakes in the sub-Saharan. We still have got challenges of drought at times, which can be more or less like ironical, because we do have one third of water, and yet you can also, when we do have drought, when we don't have rains, because our economy is agro-based, then you still have got a challenge that you don't have water, and yet we have got one third of water, which actually talks about some of the strategies that we are supposed to put in place, such as irrigation, et cetera, et cetera. We cannot deny the fact that the description by the UN and even other economic bodies has described Malawi as one of the poorest countries, living under a pound a day, which is more or less like $2 a day. In such particular situation, we don't have other elements that we can describe as persecution per se. But that the challenge in Malawi, the greatest challenge that we have, which in other words, it was supposed to be considered as a blessing, it's in a situation where out of that 22 million people, demographically, Malawi has 60% of its population being under 30 years old. Now, that tells something else, which actually talks about the productive band of the citizenry being low. So what it actually means then is that you'll be depending more on very few people that are very productive, while those many people are the ones that are actually looking up to the people that are very few. That disparity creates a very big challenge in terms of how do we sustain ourselves as individuals, even in that particular bracket. Coming from the influences of COVID, which was a global issue, but we also had faced in recent times issues to do with Cyclone Freddy, which had affected us quite a lot, and we haven't healed yet. I remember that even the statistics still talks about other 570 people that are still missing, which we cannot describe that they are dead or not. And legally, basing on our legal framework, you still need to count those people because you are not yet sure as regards to where they are. We are coming from a devastation of HIV and AIDS, which we can also not deny, which had actually affected us quite a lot starting from when HIV/AIDS was discovered in the country in 1985, coming to the year 2000-2015, where interventions had something else to say, what is it that we can actually do? The population that was highly affected in that regard was a population from age 15 to 24. This was one of the situations that had also affected our economy quite a lot, as I've already described that our nation is a young nation. This, I don't think it has been documented, but we need to appreciate before I actually talk about how Christian witness can actually help even to social justice and economics in terms of the way we place ourselves basing on what people are facing, other than just talking about church in the four corners, in the four walls of the church, but that the church being missional and also affecting other stratas within the demographics. We've actually been highly supported in that regard, especially even with the partnership with PCI. How? There was a certain moment in which one of our major commissions that was put in place to bring in interventions on HIV and AIDS in Malawi. One of the statements that one of the leaders in that particular commission had made was that the church, the Nkoma Synod, and other churches had helped quite a lot to reduce the prevalence of HIV and AIDS because of the intervention that had happened with other partners that we had. During these years, it's not because of anything else, but this has to be stated because it's a fact. One of the things that were highlighted was it was easy to reduce the prevalence of HIV/AIDS because of the programs that our synods were actually doing under the auspices of other bodies such as Scripture Union of Malawi. And during that particular time, one of the global leaders in the mission right now in PCI, Reverend David Makara, was actually there, very active. Not only that, we also had the moderator-elect, who was actually very active at a certain time with the SCOM, Student Christian Organization of Malawi, Reverend Richard Carroll, who was very significant. These men, together with their spouses, Reverend David, together with his wife, Pamela, had actually done quite a lot in helping us in other programs such as Why Wait among the young people and things like that. Programs which were very impactful in our nation. And this actually preserved and helped our nation to be protected from the scourge in as much as it would have affected us quite a lot. So if you talk about the interventions of the church going into the social fabric of the nation, one of the highlights that we can also highlight is an issue to do with these interventions that had actually happened.
Brian, thank you for sharing that particular perspective in Malawi. And certainly from within PCI, many folks have been involved in Malawi over the years, and they've visited Malawi and they will have seen firsthand what you've spoken of. Although they may have been involved in other projects, they will have recognized, going as far back as the late 80s and early 90s with the HIV/AIDS pandemic and then Cyclone Freddy, many churches, particularly involved in the south of Malawi, were able to support and help there, as well as we ourselves as a denomination. And of course, COVID, which we all were trying to hold hands together to work out how the church responds to how it moves forward post that COVID. And I guess that's one of the lovely things of having our overseas visitors with us at General Assembly, we get to hear these things. And although we can't have every partner every year, it's good that we get a snapshot each year of what's happening around the world. And more importantly, how God is at work. Not that we can clap our own hands and say, look what we have done, but that together as partners in mission, we have this opportunity to support, to help, and at most to pray, as many within this denomination do, for our global partners. And so to be able to hear this now, and for Presbyterians across this island to be able to hear these accounts of what your situations are like, particularly politically, as we know so much on our news, but also historically of what we have heard in the past and how it's continuing. We're continuing to see God at work in these situations.
Can you tell us a little bit about the challenges specifically facing Christians within your contexts, but also then from that where you have seen God working in your countries and in your churches?
Certainly, in line with what I was sharing about the general context in Lebanon, but also in Syria, I would say the most significant challenge that we as Christians face is the sense of loss of hope and loss of horizon to continue living in this part of the world. In Syria particularly, there's the sense that those who have stayed throughout the war are those who did not manage to leave, not those who necessarily chose to stay. And the tiny minority that actually did choose to stay, if you have a deep discussion with them now, they might actually express regret. In that light, it's very difficult to have a purposeful and meaningful church life. And this challenge goes across the body of the church. Even leaders sometimes stand at the pulpit and have a challenge how to address the people. What kind of message can they express when they're preaching to a population that has been displaced three times over the past 2 years, for example? So in that light, I think it's very easy for us as Christians to be cynical when there's great need as the one that our Shiite countrymen and women are facing now in the South. It's very easy to distance ourselves and say, well, this is not our conflict, and it's actually causing us trouble, and let them face the brunt of it on their own. And for me personally, this was really distressful, but I was really encouraged to see how easily this can be turned upside down when people actually get that little push to go outside of their comfort zone and be face to face with people and realize that these are humans created in the image of God, just as we are, and they value whatever we give to them, even if it's just a pat on the shoulder and prayer. And it's giving a new meaning for people who have lost meaning. So I would say this is where God is most at work at the moment. Because even in times of peace, we can't deny that our church is relatively diminishing for various reasons. Low birth rates is one of them. Immigration is another. It tends to be the case that since we have historically leaned on qualitatively investing in humans, in human beings, it tends to be that our congregation members are very equipped to just leave and find better opportunities elsewhere, instead of just staying and contending with the distress of and the pressures of living in the Middle East. So yes, for me, the most encouraging area where God is at work is this rediscovery of mission when we are face to face with human suffering. We have so many stories in that respect. It could be on any level. It could be when we recruit people as CPS. I remember distinctly we were having this call for psychosocial support facilitators and the top candidates for all Shiites. So we had a panel doing the interviews, and some of my colleagues, they told me, I mean, Amir, let's just extend the call and have more candidates. I was like, why? And they said, because, I mean, these are Shiites, we can't work with them. And I was like, why can't we? And we had this long discussion. Then we did the interviews. They met the people. And then the same people came back to me and told me, what have we been missing on? Missing out on. We tend to think that working in a faith-based organization or Christian organization should be restricted to Christians to share values, but many non-Christians on paper are willing to adopt these values. So if we're very clear that we are a Christian organization, these are our values and they're derived from our faith and from scripture, and still we accept people just as we serve people unconditionally, we accept people to serve with us unconditionally as long as we uphold these values, then I think this is our form of the best form we can muster as CPS of evangelism, when we offer everything unconditionally, just as we received everything unconditionally. In that particular story, now these people have become best friends, and they see that their friendship and their shared mission together as CPS gives meaning to why they're staying in the country and why they are letting go of that cynical predisposition that we have on a social level. There are many other stories of how the church itself as a community is actually encouraged to do more than just what we as CPS are able to equip them. So we do a small intervention in one collective shelter. They go back to us and tell us, you know what, Amir, they need much more than we can offer. Do we have your permission to do more? And I'll be like, of course, yeah. This is exactly what we'd love to hear. So it's very dark, but then again, many glimpses of light in that darkness.
And Janir, do you want to tell us a bit about the challenges and how you've seen God working?
Yeah, challenges in Hungary, I would say two major challenges. One is in line with what I mentioned with the political societal changes. It's a big challenge and a task to make an honest assessment of us as churches throughout the past years and at the present as well. To be grateful for all that we have experienced, but also to repent or to acknowledge when we failed and when we let the gospel compromised by politics. I would say it's a challenge, but a beautiful task to find again the identity of the church that is rooted in Jesus Christ. And it is quite in hand with the other big challenge, which is the experience we have been experiencing a loss in churchgoers, in the number of churchgoers, a serious decline in church attendance. And so for years, it was a kind of part of tradition for people to go to churches to attend Sunday worships or to celebrate life events in churches. And now it's gone. In cities, it's totally gone. It disappeared in villages or in the countryside. And there might be some still living traditions on that. But in totality, we have been seeing this traditional ways of church attendance disappearing. And it affects our church life on different levels. I would say, first and foremost, it's the task to understand what it means to teach the gospel in our distinctive 21st century, but post-communist, meta-modern country, and how to do it in a relevant and in some way. And there's a need for change in our system, in our denomination, in our structure, in the way how we train our pastors, how we talk about or what kind of initiatives we do in terms of discipleship in local congregations, and how we treat our traditions, for example, that can be a barrier for a lot of people who feel it's like very much outdated nowadays. So we need to get ready for the change and also have to be courageous enough to be catalysts for change as well ourselves. And change can be very frightening and it's very uncertain and risky. And so it's a normal human feeling that we try to avoid change. So to how to counteract that tendency to avoid change and how to be able to let God take us out of our comfort zone, I would say those are the challenges, the biggest ones.
Again, much there that we can recognize, probably very similar for a lot of countries across Europe. Right.
The challenges that we have in Malawi, even right now, interestingly, some of them have got to do with the way we are being bombarded culturally, ethically. For example, all the governments that have actually come, like in since the dispensation of democracy in Malawi, starting from 94, have actually been within the same threshold. Issues to do with same-sex marriages, right to life, like issues to do with abortion. The challenge that has come is because of the economic stature. As a country, there are some other bodies that cannot give us support at times because of that particular stance, whereby you need some support from other quarters. You actually be denied that particular support when the nation at that particular time is wallowing in abject poverty, and yet you also still need to back up the sovereignty and the dignity of your people. That brings in some sort of challenges, both to our civil leaders, like the leaders in government, but also at the same time in the church. Then you'd also some other challenges to do with doctrines, whereby because of poverty, sometimes you do not have a strong or solid stance in terms of scholars that can actually help you to help teach pastors in the right manner. Now, because you do not have resources, sometimes if you are partners that are coming from the international background to help you are very few, you do not have a choice but to accept anybody else who offers himself in the name of support of the church to say, we're going to come to your seminary and offer some support and teach. Now, if you have got people who are humanists, for example, their doctrine is not something that is solid from the biblical perspective, that by and by makes some inroads through the pastors, which affects our churches. Not only that, you're also talking about issues of gender. Where are you placing a woman? What is the place of a woman? What is the place of a woman in the church? Especially for a synod like mine, where they haven't yet started ordaining women. That becomes a very big challenge if you don't have an opportunity of having some other partners that can actually help you in that regard. One of the ladies was very helpful in our time was a lady by the name of Diana Cusick, who helped our women quite a lot to understand the place of a woman in the church. During that particular time, even young people were also highly affected by some of the graduates who had actually come from other secular universities to do with the issues of secularism. One of the partners that also helped us quite a lot, interestingly, was a mathematics teacher by the name of Debbie McEwen, who helped quite a lot in terms of our young people who were in secondary school, especially when she was teaching at what we call William Murray Secondary School. If you're going to ask me, how do we see God? We actually see God even through other people who are not specifically reverends or pastors, but people that have just given themselves to the Lord and say, we are going to serve, making impact, even in nations that have never been there before, such as these ladies I'm talking about. We've actually experienced that particular impact in one way or the other, where they've actually been encouraging us, praying with us, to a level that even though they are no longer with us now, but some of the ladies that they impacted, they've continued even with these responsibilities. Recently, I met a certain young man at Oliver Tambo International Airport in South Africa, who actually told me that I am not a pastor, but I was highly influenced with that mathematical teacher when I was in secondary school at William Murray. Right now, I'm a lawyer in Pretoria. I still uphold the principles. This is something that we can actually use as a very practical example of how we've also seen the Lord. But maybe in conclusion, just in this segment, is that most of my people, to be very honest, about maybe 60% of the people that I serve or we pastor in our churches are people that will only have maybe one meal a day. And they do not have an idea as regards to where their next meal is going to be coming from. If you are a pastor in that church, there is no way you can actually be there and make an example like, when you were eating breakfast. That would be a bit offensive in some other places because not everyone has had breakfast. And yet, when they come to church, having walked quite a long distances, they come there even with a smile. That's what the Holy Spirit can actually do. So this is one thing that is also making us to continue seeing that being a pastor or being a church, we haven't followed a wrong path, but that we are on the right track, seeing the faithfulness of the Lord working day in and day out. Sure.
Yeah, it's great to see or to hear a bit about the partnerships in the past and Irish missionaries who've gone out to Malawi and to various places. Good to see the impact that that's had. Could you each tell us if you have a particular message for PCI as you sit here in Belfast? Perhaps as well, if you want to tell us on any particular prayer points, how PCI members can pray for your countries, your churches, your work.
Yes, our church is about 140 years old, more or less, and it is a direct fruit of the work of the missionaries who came to the Middle East in the 19th century. Definitely more than 140 years, but bear with me. So it was handed over to the locals only in the mid-20th century. But still, the legacy of the missionaries persists. And even after the handover, the missionaries' effect was not stopped. It continued up until recently and till today. Every now and then we have missionaries, less so than before because of the situation. But then again, my point is, and maybe in line with everything that my brother and sister shared and everything that we were talking about at the beginning, personal presence makes a difference. One thing we emphasized at CPS this time, because this is not the first war we're responding to, we notice and we learned from before that material aid is needed. But, I mean, you get material aid today, it helps you for today, but what about tomorrow? Whereas human relations are long-lasting and more sustainable. And in light of the main challenges and concerns that we have about tomorrow, we made sure to emphasize that we will design everything we do today as an emergency response. We will design it as a community-based and with personal interaction at the center of anything we do. So even when we give anything that can be categorized under material aid, we would do it with a personal touch. So I would say keep us in prayer to be able to be present. Sometimes it's risky. Sometimes merely being present bears its risks. So we need prayers for courage to be present, but also it would be great, and I would like to emphasize how important it would be for others, other members of the global church to be present with us. It can be just a call or an email, sometimes even more. People go as far as visiting us. This makes a lot of difference too. It's difficult to prove, to be honest, because material support is also essential. But I would say and contend that personal support and this sense, not just for us as an organization or church, but also for the beneficiaries and participants that we work with, having the sense that we are part of a bigger community brings a lot of assurance about an uncertain future. So this would be my main prayer point.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot recently about power. And in Europe, we talk a lot, there's a lot of discussion on the notion of power and who controls power and what is the power for and how we use power. And it came to my mind the parable of Jesus when he speaks about the seed and the yeast and the power of that part of the kingdom of heaven. And I believe all over the world and in Europe, there haven't been any other way. And there is no other way for Christians to think about the power than the power of the kingdom of heaven that is represented in the mustard seed, a very tiny little seed, and the yeast. And being in Hungary, I mean, I've contacted and talked to some of the colleagues about my visit here, and I asked them also about this discussion and what do you think I should convey, and that was one of the things that they told me, that how can we pray for you? We really would like to pray for you, for our PCI, for our brothers and sisters here in Ireland, that you would continue, you would stick to that power of the living and growing power of the kingdom of heaven. And I also would like to ask you to pray for us as we go through these challenges. I've mentioned that we do not let that power of the kingdom of heaven go, and that we also in Hungary become more faithful in that calling.
I think it won't cause any harm if I don't bring anything or something new. Basing on what has already been said by Amir and also Julia, I still feel like the mandate of the church still remains. Go ye out there, even as we talk about Matthew 28, 20, but also when you talk about Acts chapter 1, verse 8, we are talking about Christian witness, starting from Jerusalem to the uttermost parts of the world. We are experiencing dynamics that are happening in the West right now, where most of our partners are pulling out because of some of the factors, either macro or on micro levels. But I would maybe request that we shouldn't be as if we are running organizations or companies, because the church continues to be the church. Now, if the church continues to be the church, and we are using strategies that we can actually use or employ when we are growing industries and organizations, I think somewhere, somehow, it is going to be a bit of a problem. Because I know issues to do with sustainability, the ones that we can actually put in business management, not everything can actually work in tandem in the church. For example, like in our synod, we are given some pillars. When we were being weaned to say, you can now become an autonomous church minus the missionaries. We're talking about issues to do with the self-governing. Yes, we do have leaders who are African. Then we're talking about self-propagation, church growth. Yes, like right now we do have 252 churches just in our synod. One congregation will have an average of like maybe 1,000 members. We don't have an issue to do with membership. Then we've got another pillar that's going to do with self-sustaining, where you have to be a church that can sustain itself. So you will see, for example, we've grown in terms of numbers. But the challenge that we have in the church, like my church, this one I cannot deny, it is a fact. We have got many members, but most of them are just nominal. They are not solid in terms of their spiritual stance. So what we are looking at now is a question which that particular servant of the Lord had actually talked about follow up. So we still make this appeal to the West. Please come and follow up on what you had actually started as missionaries. If it is not about evangelism, come and see how are we doing in terms of discipleship. Is it what you've actually, those that were evangelists, are they discipled fully? Because the problem that we have in the church in Africa right now is discipleship. Where you're talking about, in the business management, you'll be talking about training of trainers. Most of our leaders up until now, they're leaders that still needs capacity building in terms of developing leaders who can also develop other leaders. I don't want to talk too much on this, but for example, like in my church where I come from, we use a system of prayer houses where most of the people that are preaching on a Sunday are church elders who haven't had an opportunity of theological training.
But in order for us to capacitate them so that they lead those prayer houses that they are actually seen as pastors on Wednesdays and Sundays, it's a very big challenge. So our prayer is, number one, I still stand with my dear brother and sister here to say that even if the church in the West can no longer send us money, but we still require their presence to come and just to show that even us in Africa, we are part of the bigger body. That's one of the things. Even if it means just coming in for a short time, a week or two, being together with us, that is a very big need that we also have currently, even in the church in Africa. Thank you.
I think our conversation around the table today has helped us to see God at work in the past, God at work in the present, but also trusting God for the future. The psalmist writes throughout the Psalms about the steadfast love of the Lord. And in each context that we've heard, even within our own Presbyterian Irish context and the General Assembly that is ahead of us, we will have the opportunity to listen to the global church of where the global church is and what we can learn from the global church. But it must also be looking to the future and to know that the God who has kept us, sustained us in the past, will continue to do that in the future. And I guess that's what is beautiful about this time of the year, not just General Assembly, and there are many General Assembly enthusiasts out there. But for Irish Presbyterians, we don't simply look at our own house. We look at what God is doing throughout the world. And Brian, I think you've ended there with a wonderful picture, as Julia and Amir have said as well, of what it looks like to be part of the Church of Jesus Christ in this day and what God is doing for the growth of his kingdom, but not just growth numerically, growth in maturity, growth in depth, so that we will see a vibrant Church of Christ throughout this world, where we will see the lost one with the gospel and discipleship rooted, so that they will stay the course of faith. And as Paul says, not make shipwreck of their faith, but stay the course until Christ comes and will take us home.
So I think that's a good place for us to finish up. I want to just say thank you again to all of you for being involved this morning and for the words that you've said. I think that has been really helpful for us to be able to see a bit more of what's happening in the global church. And we're looking forward to that continuing through this week of General Assembly. So thank you again. And it's great to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Presbyterian Church in Ireland. Thanks for joining us.